The Secret of Chimneys, Agatha Christie. Chapter 19, Secret History. They all stared at the French detective, who smiled back at them. "But yes," he said, "it is true." There was a pause for a general readjusting of ideas. Then Virginia turned to Battle. "Do you know what I think, Superintendent Battle?" "What do you think, Mrs. Revel?" "I think the time has come to enlighten us a little." "To enlighten you? I don't quite understand, Mrs. Revel." "Superintendent Battle, you understand perfectly. I dare say Mr. Lomax has hedged you about with recommendations of secrecy. George would, but surely it's better to tell us than have us stumbling on the secret all by ourselves, and perhaps doing untold harm. Monsieur Lemoine, don't you agree with me?"
"Madame, I agree with you entirely."
"You can't go on keeping things dark forever," said Battle. "I've told Mr. Lomax so. Mr. Eversley is Mr. Lomax's secretary. There's no objection to his knowing what there is to know. As for Mr. Cade, he's been brought into this thing willy-nilly, and I consider he's a right to know where he stands. But..." Battle paused. "I know," said Virginia, "women are so indiscreet. I've often heard George say so." Lemoine had been studying Virginia attentively. Now he turned to the Scotland Yard man. "Did I hear you just now address Madame by the name of Revel?"
"That's my name," said Virginia.
"Your husband was in the diplomatic service, was he not? And you were with him in Herzegovina just before the assassination of the late king and queen."
"Yes."
Lemoine turned again. "I think Madame has a right to hear the story. She is indirectly concerned. Moreover," his eyes twinkled a little, "Madame's reputation for discretion stands very high in diplomatic circles."
"I'm glad you give me a good character," said Virginia, laughing, "and I'm glad I'm not going to be left out of it."
"What about refreshments?" said Anthony. "Where does the conference take place? Here?"
"If you please, sir," said Battle, "I've a fancy for not leaving this room until morning. You'll see why when you've heard the story."
"Then I'll go and forage," said Anthony. Bill went with him, and they returned with a tray of glasses, siphons, and other necessaries of life. The augmented syndicate established itself comfortably in the corner by the window, being grouped round a long oak table.
"It's understood, of course," said Battle, "that anything that's said here is said in strict confidence. There must be no leakage. I've always felt it would come out one of these days. Gentlemen like Mr. Lomax, who want everything hushed up, take bigger risks than they think. The start of this business was just over 7 years ago. There was a lot of what they call reconstruction going on, especially in the Near East. There was a good deal going on in England, strictly on the QT, with that old gentleman, Count Stilpitch, pulling the strings. All the Balkan states were interested parties, and there were a lot of royal personages in England just then. I'm not going into details, but something disappeared. Disappeared in a way that seemed incredible unless you admitted two things. That the thief was a royal personage, and that at the same time, it was the work of a high-class professional. Monsieur Lemoine here will tell you how that well might be." The Frenchman bowed courteously and took up the tale.
"It is possible that you in England may not even have heard of our famous and fantastic King Victor. What his real name is, no one knows, but he is a man of singular courage and daring, one who speaks five languages and is unequaled in the art of disguise. Though his father is known to have been either English or Irish, he himself has worked chiefly in Paris. It was there, nearly 8 years ago, that he was carrying out a daring series of robberies and living under the name of Captain O'Neill." A faint exclamation escaped Virginia. Monsieur Lemoine darted a keen glance at her.
I think I understand what agitates Madame. You will see in a minute. Now, we of the Sûreté had our suspicions that this Captain O'Neill was none other than King Victor, but we could not obtain the necessary proof. There was also in Paris at the time a clever young actress, Angèle Marie, of the Folies Bergères. For some time, we had suspected that she was associated with the operations of King Victor. But again, no proof was forthcoming. About that time, Paris was preparing for the visit of the young King Nicholas IV of Herzegovina. At the Sûreté, we were given special instructions as to the course to be adopted to ensure the safety of His Majesty. In particular, we were warned to superintend the activities of a certain revolutionary organization which called itself the Comrades of the Red Hand. It is fairly certain now that the comrades approached Angèle Marie and offered her a huge sum if she would aid them in their plans. Her part was to infatuate the young king and decoy him to some spot agreed upon with them. Angèle Marie accepted the bribe and promised to perform her part. But the young lady was cleverer and more ambitious than her employers suspected. She succeeded in captivating the king, who fell desperately in love with her and loaded her with jewels. It was then that she conceived the idea of being not a king's mistress, but a queen. As everyone knows, she realized her ambition. She was introduced into Herzegovina as the Countess Varaga Popolevsky, an offshoot of the Romanovs, and became eventually Queen Varaga of Herzegovina. Not bad for a little Parisian actress. I have always heard that she played the part extremely well, but her triumph was not to be long-lived. The comrades of the Red Hand, furious at her betrayal, twice attempted her life. Finally, they worked up the country to such a pitch that a revolution broke out in which both the king and queen perished. Their bodies, horribly mutilated and hardly recognizable, were recovered, attesting to the fury of the populace against the low-born foreign queen. Now, in all this, it seems certain that Queen Varaga still kept in with her confederate, King Victor. It is possible that the bold plan was his all along. What is known is that she continued to correspond with him in a secret code from the court of Herzegovina. For safety, the letters were written in English and signed with the name of an English lady then at the embassy. If any inquiry had been made and the lady in question had denied her signature, it is possible that she would not have been believed, for the letters were those of a guilty woman to her lover. It was your name she used, Mrs. Revel. I know, said Virginia. Her color was coming and going unevenly. So that is the truth of the letters. I have wondered and wondered. What a blackguardly trick, cried Bill indignantly. The letters were addressed to Captain O'Neill at his rooms in Paris, and their principal purpose may have light shed upon it by a curious fact which came to light later. After the assassination of the king and queen, many of the crown jewels, which had fallen, of course, into the hands of the mob, found their way to Paris. And it was discovered that, in 9 cases out of 10, the principal stones had been replaced by paste. And mind you, there were some very famous stones among the jewels of Herzegovina. So as a queen, Angèle Marie still practiced her former activities. You see now where we have arrived. Nicholas IV and Queen Varaga came to England and were the guests of the late Marquis of Cattenham, then Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs. Herzegovina is a small country, but it could not be left out. Queen Viraga was necessarily received, and there we have a royal personage, and at the same time, an expert thief. And at the same time, an expert thief. There's also no doubt that the substitute, which was so wonderful as to deceive anyone but an expert, could only have been fashioned by King Victor. And indeed the whole plan, in its daring and audacity, pointed to him as the author. "What happened?" asked Virginia. "Hushed up," said Superintendent Battle laconically. "Not a mention of it's ever been made public to this day. We did all that could be done on the quiet. And that was a good deal more than you'd ever imagine, by the way. We've got methods of our own that would surprise. That jewel didn't leave England with the Queen of Herzoslovakia, I can tell you that much. No, Her Majesty hid it somewhere, but where, we've never been able to discover. But I shouldn't wonder," Superintendent Battle let his eyes wander gently round, "if it wasn't somewhere in this room." Anthony leapt to his feet. "What? After all these years?" he cried incredulously. "Impossible!"
"You do not know the peculiar circumstances, monsieur," said the Frenchman quickly. "Only a fortnight later, the revolution in Herzoslovakia broke out, and the king and queen were murdered. Also, Captain O'Neill was arrested in Paris and sentenced on a minor charge. We hoped to find the packet of code letters in his house, but it appears that this had been stolen by some Herzoslovakian go-between. The man turned up in Herzoslovakia just before the revolution, and then disappeared completely."
"He probably went abroad," said Anthony thoughtfully. "To Africa, as likely as not. And you bet he hung on to that packet. It was as good as a gold mine to him. It's odd how things come about. They probably called him Dutch Pedro or something like that out there."
He caught Superintendent Battle's expressionless glance bent upon him and smiled. "It's not really clairvoyance, Battle," he said, "though it sounds like it. I'll tell you presently."
"There's one thing that you have not explained," said Virginia. "Where does this link up with the memoirs? There must be a link, surely."
"Madame is very quick," said Lemoine approvingly. "Yes, there is a link. Count Stilpitch was also staying at Chimneys at the time."
"So that he might have known about it."
"Parfaitement."
"And of course," said Battle, "if he's blurted it out in his precious memoirs, the fat will be in the fire, especially after the way the whole thing was hushed up."
Anthony lit a cigarette. "There's no possibility of there being a clue in the memoirs as to where the stone was hidden?" he asked.
"Very unlikely," said Battle decisively. "He was never in with the queen. Opposed the marriage tooth and nail. She's not likely to have taken him into her confidence."
"I wasn't suggesting such a thing for a minute," said Anthony. "But by all accounts, he was a cunning old boy. Unknown to her, he may have discovered where she hid the jewel. In that case, what would he have done, do you think?"
"Sat tight," said Battle, after a moment's reflection.
"I agree," said the Frenchman. "It was a ticklish moment, you see. To return the stone anonymously would have presented great difficulties. Also, the knowledge of its whereabouts would give him great power, and he liked power, that strange old man. Not only did he hold the queen in the hollow of his hand, but he had a powerful weapon to negotiate with at any time. It was not the only secret he possessed. Oh, no. He collected secrets like some men collect rare pieces of china. It is said that once or twice before his death, he boasted to people of the things he could make public if the fancy took him. And once at least, he declared that he intended to make some startling revelations in his memoirs. Hence," the Frenchman smiled rather dryly, "the general anxiety to get hold of them.
Our own secret police intended to seize them, but the Count took the precaution to have them conveyed away before his death. Still, there's no real reason to believe that he knew this particular secret, said Battle.
I beg your pardon, said Anthony quietly.
There are his own words.
What?
Both detectives stared at him as though unable to believe their ears. When Mr. McGrath gave me that manuscript to bring to England, he told me the circumstances of his one meeting with Count Stilpich. It was in Paris, at some considerable risk to himself. Mr. McGrath rescued the Count from a band of Apaches. He was, I understand, shall we say a trifle, exhilarated. Being in that condition, he made two rather interesting remarks. One of them was to the effect that he knew where the Koh-i-Noor was, a statement to which my friend paid very little attention. He also said that the gang in question were King Victor's men. Taken together, those two remarks are very significant.
Good Lord! Ejaculated Superintendent Battle. I should say they were. Even the murder of Prince Michael wears a different aspect.
King Victor has never taken a life, the Frenchman reminded him.
Supposing he were surprised when he was searching for the jewel.
Is he in England, then? Asked Anthony sharply. You say that he was released a few months ago. Didn't you keep track of him?
A rather rueful smile overspread the French detective's face.
We tried to, monsieur.
But he is the devil, that man. He gave us the slip at once.
At once.
We thought, of course, that he would make straight for England, but no. He went. Where do you think?
Where? Said Anthony.
He was staring intently at the Frenchman, and absentmindedly played with a box of matches.
To America. To the United States.
What?
There was sheer amazement in Anthony's tone.
Yes.
And what do you think he called himself? What part do you think he played over there?
The part of Prince Nicholas of Herzegovina.
The matchbox fell from Anthony's hand, but his amazement was fully equaled by that of Battle.
Impossible!
Not so, my friend. You too will get the news in the morning. It has been the most colossal bluff. As you know, Prince Nicholas was rumored to have died in the Congo years ago. Our friend, King Victor, seizes on that. Difficult to prove a death of that kind. He resurrects Prince Nicholas and plays him to such purpose that he gets away with a tremendous haul of American dollars, all on account of the supposed oil concessions. But by a mere accident, he was unmasked and had to leave the country hurriedly. This time, he did come to England, and that is why I am here. Sooner or later, he will come to Chimneys. That is, if he's not already here.
You think that?
I think he was here the night Prince Michael died, and again last night.
It was another attempt, eh? Said Battle.
It was another attempt.
What has bothered me, continued Battle, was wondering what had become of Monsieur Lemoine here. I'd had word from Paris that he was on his way over to work with me and couldn't make out why he hadn't turned up.
I must indeed apologize, said Lemoine. You see, I arrived on the morning after the murder. It occurred to me at once that it would be as well for me to study things from an unofficial standpoint without appearing officially as your colleague. I thought that great possibilities lay that way. I was, of course, aware that I was bound to be an object of suspicion, but that, in a way, furthered my plan, since it would not put the people I was after on their guard. I can assure you that I have seen a good deal that is interesting in the last 2 days.
But look here, said Bill. What really did happen last night?
I'm afraid, said Monsieur Lemoine, that I gave you rather violent exercise.
It was you I chased then?
Yes, I will recount things to you. I came up here to watch, convinced that the secret had to do with this room, since the prince had been killed here. I stood outside on the terrace. Presently, I became aware that someone was moving about in this room. I could see the flash of a torch now and again. I tried the middle window and found it unlatched. Whether the man had entered that way earlier, or whether he had left it so as a blind in case he was disturbed, I don't know. Very gently, I pushed it back and slipped inside the room. Step by step, I felt my way until I was in a spot where I could watch operations without likelihood of being discovered myself. The man himself I could not see clearly. His back was to me, of course, and he was silhouetted against the light of the torch so that his outline only could be seen. But his actions filled me with surprise. He took to pieces first one and then the other of those two suits of armor, examining each one piece by piece. When he had convinced himself that what he sought was not there, he began tapping the paneling of the wall under that picture. What he would have done next, I don't know. The interruption came. You burst in. He looked at Bill. Our well-meant interference was really rather a pity, said Virginia thoughtfully. In a sense, madame, it was. The man switched out his torch, and I, who had no wish as yet to be forced to reveal my identity, sprang for the window. I collided with the other two in the dark and fell headlong. I sprang up and out through the window. Mr. Eversley, taking me for his assailant, followed. I followed you first, said Virginia. Bill was only second in the race. And the other fellow had the sense to stay still and sneak out through the door. I wonder he didn't meet the rescuing crowd. That would present no difficulties, said Lemoine. He would be a rescuer in advance of the rest, that was all. Do you really think this Arsène Lupin fellow is actually among the household now? Asked Bill, his eyes sparkling. Why not? Said Lemoine. He could pass perfectly as a servant. For all we know, he may be Boris Anchukov, the trusted servant of the late Prince Michael. He's an odd-looking bloke, agreed Bill. But Anthony was smiling. That's hardly worthy of you, Monsieur Lemoine, he said gently. The Frenchman smiled too. You've taken him on as your valet now, haven't you, Mr. Cade? Asked Superintendent Battle. Battle, I take off my hat to you. You know everything. But just as a matter of detail, he's taken me on, not I him. Why was that, I wonder, Mr. Cade? I don't know, said Anthony lightly. It's a curious taste, but perhaps he may have liked my face. Or he may think I murdered his master and wished to establish himself in a handy position for executing revenge upon me. He rose and went over to the windows, pulling the curtains. Daylight, he said with a slight yawn. There won't be any more excitements now. Lemoine rose also. I will leave you, he said. We shall perhaps meet again later in the day. With a graceful bow to Virginia, he stepped out of the window. Bed, said Virginia, yawning. It's all been very exciting. Come on, Bill. Go to bed like a good little boy. The breakfast table will see us not, I fear. Anthony stayed at the window looking after the retreating form of Monsieur Lemoine. You wouldn't think it, said Battle behind him, but that's supposed to be the cleverest detective in France. I don't know that I wouldn't, said Anthony, thoughtfully. I rather think I would. Well, said Battle, he was right about the excitements of this night being over. By the way, do you remember my telling you about that man they'd found shot near Staines? Yes, why? Nothing. They've identified him, that's all. It seems he was called Giuseppe Manuelli. He was a waiter at the Blitz in London. Curious, isn't it?